Can I ask you to welcome Andrew Lee, please?
Well, thanks, Gary, for a very generous introduction. It's a real pleasure to share the stage with Shelley and also to have Alan Fells here in the audience. Can I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and also to thank Monica and Romy for the very hard work in putting today's event together, and to all of you for taking your some time out of your busy days to talk about the topic of inequality. In late 2001, at the age of 55, the Australian journalist Elizabeth Winehousen decided to take leave from her job and try life as a low-wage worker. Following in the footsteps of George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London and Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed, Winehousen's Dirt Cheap documents her year living in budget accommodation and working at entry-level jobs. In one job, Winehousen moved to a country town and worked packing eggs. She earned $14 an hour in a job that started at 6 a.m, left her body aching at the end of the day, and where the smell from the chook sheds was constant. 3 weeks in, the manager, a millionaire several times over, came to speak to the workers. He announced the company was selling the egg division. "It's not all doom and gloom," he told them. They knew their jobs were going. Winehousen was struck by the fact that none of them challenged the manager. She wrote, "Seeing them standing mute in front of the boss was like seeing them stripped of all defences." In another job, Winehousen worked as a cleaner, noting that her interviewer seemed to treat her as if one cleaner were the same as another, and one cleaning job the same as the next. She was pleased to get the job immediately, but then realised that she'd simply earned the right to be on permanent standby, to work if and when other employees were sick or on holidays. Again and again, she witnessed workplaces where flexibility meant the employers had the workers on call 24/7, but could always cut their shifts if customer demand fell. A couple of years ago, I wrote Battlers and Billionaires, the story of inequality in Australia. And there I set out to tell the story of the great Australian egalitarian tradition, to explore how fairness is woven through our social fabric. In Japanese prisoner of war camps, Australians like Weary Dunlop and Tom Uren made sure that our troops shared what they had, and as a result, that more of them walked out alive. Unlike other nations, Australians don't have private areas on the beaches. We call each other mate, and we comfortably sit in the front seat of taxis. On the sporting field, salary caps, player drafts, and revenue sharing are all ways of making the game fairer and more interesting. The central argument of Battlers and Billionaires is to warn of the risk that this great egalitarian culture might be coming adrift from the economic reality of inequality. Over the past generation, Australia's top 1% share has doubled. Our top 0.1% share has tripled. Our nation has twice as many private planes as it did a decade ago. And yet 1 in 7 Australians can't afford dental care. Since I wrote that book in 2013, the conversation over inequality has only grown more intense. Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century has proven that economic history is not dead, and indeed that there's an appetite for big thinking on how unequal we want to become. Last year, Pope Francis called for the legitimate redistribution of economic benefits by the state, as well as the indispensable cooperation between the private sector and civil society. In his recent State of the Union address, Barack Obama focused squarely on the risk that excessive inequality poses to social mobility, to the American dream itself. And alongside Piketty, the Pope, and the President, it would be remiss of me to forget our Prime Minister. Last year's budget might have been the most regressive in living memory, but the community reaction has reinvigorated the conversation about inequality. So while I disagree with their politics, I should thank our Knights and Dames Prime Minister and his cigar-smoking Treasurer for putting egalitarianism back on page one where it belongs. In this talk, I want to focus on the question of why inequality matters and what we can do about it. But to begin with, let's talk about a key source of inequality. A significant portion of the rise in Australian inequality over the past decade relates to changes in the labour market. Work is the principal source of income for most households, and the gap between the well-paid and the low-paid has been steadily growing. From 1975 to 2014, real wages have risen by $7,000 for the bottom tenth and by $47,000 for the top tenth. Put another way, the top tenth of Australian earners have received a pay rise that is bigger than the total pay of the bottom tenth. In percentage terms, those at the bottom have seen an earnings rise of 23%, while those at the top have seen an earnings rise of 72%, three times more. If cleaners and checkout workers had received the same proportionate pay rise as solicitors and surgeons, they'd be $16,000 a year better off. One reason for this decline is the decline of union density over this period. If you want a single institution in the Australian labour market that acts as a bulwark against inequality, it's unions. Unions tend to bargain for dollar pay increases, which disproportionately benefit those at the bottom. Advocate pay equity across firms and across industries. Unions have underpinned key campaigns for pay equity for women and Indigenous Australians. Another major driver of inequality are the twin forces of technology and globalisation. Computers can now beat world chess champions and fly a helicopter. Global outsourcing is possible with everything from record keeping in healthcare to designing your website. A recent economics paper estimated that 47% of occupations could be replaced by a computer within a few decades, with the odds being especially high in occupations such as dishwashers, 77%, pharmacy technicians, 92%, and telemarketers, 99%. An XKCD cartoon featured one character saying, well, at least humans are better at coming up with reassuring parables about things that humans are better at. And then the comic strip finishes with a computer running a program that generates thousands of reassuring parables every second. It's true that some high-wage occupations are under threat, but the likely effect is what economists call skill-biased technological change. It's the general rule that technology tends to raise the wages of high-skilled workers more than low-skilled workers. For example, in my former profession of law, the computer revolution raised the earnings of partners, while it just as it rendered thousands of typists redundant. But does it matter if earnings are rising faster at the top than the bottom, if the ocean liners are rising faster than the tugboats? One concern about inequality is that societies with a large gulf separating the haves and the have-nots are those in which few people escape the circumstances of their birth. Think of a ladder. If inequality measures the gap between the rungs, then intergenerational mobility measures how easy it is to climb up or indeed to slip down. If the rungs move further apart, the ladder becomes harder for someone to climb. In a very unequal society, you're more likely to stay on your birth rung. In Australia, income mobility across generations is worse than in Scandinavia, but better than in the United States. This can be a bit of an abstract concept, so let's make it a little more concrete by using the comparison of the hereditability of height. In the United States, the hereditability of income is similar to the hereditability of height. In Australia, the effect is only half as strong. But in countries such as Sweden and Denmark, the hereditability of income is smaller still. Some people say we should put up with large inequalities, so long as anyone can move from rags to riches. But we now know that the two are linked. The more unequal society becomes, the more that a parent's income will determine where their child ends up. Perhaps to the stage, like the United States, where you're as likely to inherit your economic position from your parents as you are to inherit your height from your parents. More inequality means less social mobility, a relationship that Princeton's Alan Krueger has dubbed the Great Gatsby Curve. Another reason that inequality matters comes from a simple thought experiment. Suppose you had an equal chance of being born into any of the five wealth quintiles in Australia. Would you prefer to be born into a society where the rich had 60 times as much wealth as the poor? Or would you prefer a society in which the rich had 1.5 times as much wealth as the poor? The first ratio represents the true distribution of wealth in Australia. But when surveyed about their ideal distribution, the majority of respondents want Australia to be more egalitarian. Indeed, the ratio of the rich having 1.5 times as much as the poor is the average survey response of the most affluent survey respondents. Economic inequality may have risen, but egalitarianism remains fundamental to the Australian national identity. Ours is a nation where, as the early settlers likes to say, Jack was as good as his master, or probably better. As one early 19th century commentator put it, in England, the average man feels he's an inferior. In America, that he is a superior. In Australia, he feels that he is an equal. That is indeed delightful. Mark Twain saw it. Anthony Trollope saw it. D.H. Lawrence saw it. It wasn't a dream, and we didn't make it up. Egalitarianism is a regular feature of speeches by my Labor colleagues. Michelle Rowland sums up the appeal of Australia to migrants as being prosperous, free, and instinctively egalitarian. Bill Shorten has noted that ours is a country where the welfare of the weakest and the welfare of the most powerful are inextricably bound together. Andrew Giles warns we mustn't return Australia to a gilded age of inequality, whereby if you're not born into wealth, the game of life is rigged against you. Penny Wong notes that a critical ingredient for a fairer society is equality of opportunity. Brendan O'Connor points out that the idea that inequality is the price of growth, that prosperity and equity are alternatives, isn't borne out by a calm examination of the evidence. Others note the intergenerational consequences of inequality. Pat Conroy says, I have a 1-year-old daughter and I want her to grow up in a society that is fair and equitable, where she has the best chance of advancing based on her hard effort and her intelligence, not on the size of the bank balance supporting her. Jim Chalmers succinctly points out that inequality in one generation breeds inequality in the next. Tanya Plibersek draws attention to the global ramifications of inequality. She says there's a simple idea that we should, where possible, work to eliminate some of the most dire forms of inequality that exist in our world. This speaks to something larger than a mere policy difference. We see a role for government in tackling inequality, whether it be at home or abroad. Inequality need not just be an issue of the left. And yet, I searched in vain for a single comment of this kind from one of my colleagues on the right side of politics. It wasn't always that way. A century ago, Republican President Theodore Roosevelt told an audience in Kansas, the absence of effective restraint upon unfair money getting has tended to create a small class of enormously wealthy and economically powerful men, whose chief object is to hold and increase their power. In June 2000, the Australian newspaper published a week-long series on inequality. Its lead editor, Paul Kelly, argued that inequality in Australia today is a serious social issue. But a decade and a half on, with inequality higher still, there's little evidence that those on the right take inequality seriously. Prime Minister Abbott's view is that, in the end, we have to be a productive and competitive society, and greater inequality might be inevitable. His hand-picked business advisor, Maurice Newman, believes we shouldn't talk about inequality because words such as equality and egalitarian have become a refuge for bad policy. Christopher Pyne states boldly, "I don't believe there's an equity problem in Australia." And in response to NatSEM modelling, showing that last year's budget made poor single parents 11% worse off and rich singles better off, Joe Hockey described his critics as engaging in 1970s class warfare, an old-style socialism. Every time I hear someone on the right criticising talk of inequality as class warfare, I think of Warren Buffett's response. He says, "There's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning." We need a deeper conversation about inequality. I say to my coalition colleagues, if you'd like to engage in a serious, evidence-based debate about inequality, just name the time and place. With Australian inequality as high as it's been in three quarters of a century, we can't afford to have the nation's conservatives shouting slogans. We need them engaged in a serious conversation about how much inequality our social fabric can bear. So if you accept the argument that inequality matters, what should we do about it? The first answer is that we must increase the quality and quantity of education in Australia. Harvard's Claudia Golden and Larry Katz argue that we should regard inequality as the product of a race between education and technology. At times when education expands rapidly, egalitarianism flourishes. But when technology advances, while education stagnates, inequality grows. Boosting educational attainment means making it easier for students to attend and complete vocational training and university, and improving the quality of school teachers and university lecturers. As Bill Shorten's put it, affordable and accessible education boosts social mobility. The typical worker earns between $1 and $5 million over the course of their lifetime. That means, for most of you, the most valuable thing you own isn't your house, it's your human capital. Economists aren't much good at predicting precisely which occupations will grow and shrink over future decades. But we can be pretty confident that there will be more jobs for people with diplomas and degrees and fewer for people who didn't finish high school. Second, we need to do a better job of evaluating our social policies. At present, too many evaluations are themselves B grade, C grade, or worse. Testing new social policies by means of medical-style randomised trials would provide better information about what works. Right now, randomised trials are compulsory for pharmaceuticals, but almost non-existent for social policies. How does that make sense? Raising the evidence bar isn't just about a better feedback loop. It also embodies a more modest approach to politics. If we knew everything about how to help the truly disadvantaged, we wouldn't have multi-generational poverty cycles, wide educational achievement gaps, and a burgeoning jail population. If we believe Australia should become more equal, we need to combine optimism about addressing the problem with realism about the ability of any particular policy to get us there. Third, Australia must ensure that our tax and transfer system works to reduce inequality. Historically, as Chris Bowens noted, Australia's welfare system can be regarded as among the most efficient in the world. The average advanced country gives twice as much welfare to the bottom fifth of the population as the top fifth, while Australia gives 12 times as much to the poor as to the rich. This is a political choice, not a guaranteed outcome. Under the Howard government, a recent study has shown that the redistributive effect of government payments declined by one quarter. During our two terms in office, Labor chose a different path. The National Disability Insurance Scheme recognises what Bill Shorten, quoting Gough Whitlam, called the inequality of luck for people with a disability. I'm pleased to see that the NDIS now enjoys bipartisan support. But no one should doubt that it required a Labor government to bring an NDIS into existence. Labor also chose to reduce inequality by focusing on the neediest. In 2007, a single pension was worth two-fifths of median income. Using the half-median earnings benchmark that's often defined as being in poverty, that meant that if you got the full-rate single pension, you're in poverty. 2 years later, Labor increased the pension to over half the median income, the largest increase in a century. And as Jenny Macklin has pointed out, the effect of that was to move a million pensioners out of poverty. It's easy to talk in banal generalities about the virtues of means testing, but the acid test is how you respond when a particular means test debate comes before Parliament. When Labor means tested the baby bonus to exclude just the top 6% of families, Malcolm Turnbull called it an appeal to Labor's divisive envy politics. When Labor froze indexation on a family tax benefit supplement and scaled back the dependent spouse tax offset, Joe Hockey said, "I despise this envy and this jealousy." When the baby bonus was scaled back for second and subsequent children, Christopher Pyne called the decision vicious and savage, and Joe Hockey compared it to China's one-child policy. By contrast, Labor supported a number of the Abbott government's means-testing decisions, even in cases where we believe the policy could have been better designed. Over the course of 2015, Labor will have much more to say about how we believe the budget should be shaped. But let me just point to one issue within my portfolio: multinational profit shifting. In its first year in office, while cutting the pay of the people who clean their offices, the Abbott government gave $1.1 billion back to multinational firms, no strings attached. These firms, some with multi-billion dollar profits, didn't need a tax handout from the Abbott government. In fact, it's probably fair to say they needed a tax break about as much as Prince Philip needed a knighthood. Australia's egalitarian spirit shows up in unexpected places. Writing in the Financial Review, the entrepreneur Christopher Joy argued that the competitive nature of sport proved Australians didn't believe in inequality. "We do not handicap an athlete," Joy argued, "because they are abnormally fast." It turns out this is exactly how our sports often operate. Many Australian team sports have salary caps. Many individual sports have handicap systems. As any golfer can tell you, handicaps make the game more fun because they allow people of different abilities to compete with one another. We don't just handicap sports people. Australia's favourite horse race, the Melbourne Cup, literally puts lead in the saddlebags. Horses must carry at least 49 kilograms, and racing historians celebrate Carbine, who won the 1890 Melbourne Cup with a whopping 66 kilograms in the saddlebags. Extra weight is put on horses who've already performed well. And I'd contrast that with America's most famous race, the Kentucky Derby, which doesn't add weight based on the horse's past performance. The Melbourne Cup is a more egalitarian race than the Kentucky Derby. Now, no one's arguing we should put lead in the saddlebags of the most successful Australians. But in the great Australian foot race, isn't it time to consider buying a pair of shoes for the barefoot kid up the back of the pack? Our egalitarian spirit helped make Australia a stable, cohesive and prosperous nation over the past two centuries. We still have this ethos strongly present in our society, even as inequality has risen starkly and significantly in the past generation. Egalitarianism is a value that runs deep in the Australian popular psyche, with undeniable origins in our history and culture, an undeniable continued appeal in our democratic society. But I worry that unless we consciously refocus on equality as our shared goal and egalitarianism as our common value, Australia will sleepwalk into a more unequal and divided future, that we will find ourselves split into two Australias. Australians have expressed a strong preference for egalitarianism. We know from the evidence that a more equal society is a more mobile society. To achieve it, we need a government that will put fairness at the heart of policymaking. A government that will be, as Australia is, egalitarian to the core. Thank you very much.